This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Wildfires in California this fall have left thousands homeless and caused more than $1 billion in damage. Unfortunately, this kind of fire isn't as rare as it used to be. And forecasters say that by 2050, we can expect to see a doubling or even tripling of the size of areas affected by wildfires. What's driving that growth is a complex mixture of climate change, forest management practices, and, of course, expanding development and recreation in and near forest areas. Author and scholar Edward Struzik digs into the science of wildfires, past, present, and future, in his new book, Firestorm: How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. Ed, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. Throughout the book, you kind of follow this one particular fire, the 2016 Horse River Fire, also called The Beast by some who were involved. It was the costliest natural disaster in Canadian history. How would that fire compare with California this season?
It only compares in the sense that 88,000 people had to evacuate at the very last minute. And they were all very fortunate. There was a combination of demographics, wind changes, and pure luck that resulted in the fact that no one died. But in terms of comparing it to California, it's kind of comparing apples and oranges in a way, because it's an industrial town, whereas California is more of an urban forest community. But I think California has a longer history with fire. Fort McMurray, they've have fires in that area, but nothing that resulted in a major evacuation like this. I mean, this caught the world's attention. The Pope, you know, sent his condolences. Vladimir Putin offered to help. People followed it on the internet with, you know, absolute amazement. It was really social media captured the intensity of the fire for the first time. So I think that Fort McMurray raised, you know, public attention to what these fires can do. And now California is, you know, seeing basically how it happens in reality.
The issue of wildfires is certainly not new. And in the book, at one point, you kind of rattle off a list of big wildfires going back, I don't know, 150 years. There's Miramichi, 2.9 million acres burned, 1,200 people killed in New Brunswick and Maine in 1825. 1871, 18 towns in Wisconsin burned. Again, 1,200 people killed. I mean, you've got this whole list. But you say that those were big wildfires, and what we're now seeing are something you call megafires. What's the difference, and what's driving that change?
Well, a number of things are driving it. Number one is climate change. The forests are getting hotter and drier, and so there's a lot more kindling there to burn. The biggest factor, I think, is that we have now 46 million single-family homes, several hundred thousand businesses, and 120 million people living and working in around the forests of the United States. And that pace of development is continuing, and it's most pronounced in the American West, where it's really dry and hot. And unfortunately, people are responsible for most of the fires that start in a forest. And so it's sort of like a mathematical equation. You can't get around the fact that people and forests in an era of climate change just don't mix.
I mean, if you think about this, as you said, like an equation, climate change is part of it, and this pattern of human development and forest use is part of it. How big are those two factors relative to each other? Are they about equal? Is this mostly a climate change problem, or is this mostly a development problem?
I would say that they're almost equal in importance. The climate change, without a doubt, is really setting us up for, you know, these catastrophic events. The problem is that we have so many people living and working and playing in these forests that something's got to click or go bad. But I think the third part of that equation is that we still haven't kind of come to grips with wildfire in North America or throughout the world, as we've seen in Portugal and Chile and Mexico and everywhere else in the last year there have been major fires. We haven't made ourselves very resilient to these fires. We continue to build wood homes with cedar shingle roofs. We plant ornamental cedars and eucalyptus around homes to make them look good. And so when fire burns, you know, you can get embers traveling 2 miles from a fire. And that can, if it lands on a roof, start a fire. And once one house goes, another house goes. And we're just not prepared for that. And we've kind of ignored this new, you know, meteorological event. You know, we're all sort of prepared for tornadoes and hurricanes. There's all kinds of public health or public warnings about what to do to evacuate. But fires, we're still, you know, we're kind of the deer in the headlight syndrome. We just haven't come to grips with it.
I'm talking with Edward Struzik. He's author of Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. While you're talking about hurricanes and tornadoes, you mentioned in the book that essentially these mega fires have the same energy. They're kind of on the same scale as something like a hurricane or tornado. And as you said, our attitudes are completely different. We have warning systems for those weather events, but we don't try to stop them. We don't think that we can put up a wall and stop a hurricane. Whereas we don't have those warning systems in place for fire. And for some reason, we do think that we can stop them. And we try to stop them and put out the fires. Do you think that's a realistic attitude at this point with some of these really huge fires that you've looked at? I mean, firefighters have had to, in some cases, say, we're just no match for this.
They're right. I mean, virtually every wildfire expert has told me that once a fire gets to a certain size, and depending on the wind conditions at the time, there's really nothing that they can do to stop it. They can maybe slow it. They can maybe make it or help make it move in a different direction. But when you get something like has happened in California this past few weeks with those winds, it's kind of like, you know, those retardants, all that water that they're dropping on the fire is sort of like spitting on a campfire. It has really no impact. And to some extent, it's a public relations strategy, is that the firefighters have to be seen to be doing something. In most cases, they really are doing something. They're trying to protect homes and people. But when they drop those retardants, it's kind of a hope and a prayer. And the energy in these fires are really remarkable. They can create their own thunderstorms, like the one in Fort McMurray created its own thunderstorm with no rain, but lightning that triggered fires 20 miles in advance of the fire front, if you can imagine that. No one has seen anything like that. It probably happened before, but we haven't been able to document it. So what do you do with, you know, how does a firefighter deal with a lightning storm coming from a wildfire that's triggering fires 20 miles in advance of it? It's sort of like dragons in the forest. You know, it's you can't slay these dragons.
Let's talk about specifically how it is that climate change is making these fires worse. One part of it is actually creating the conditions for more thunderstorms, not necessarily the fire-created thunderstorms, but just thunderstorms with lightning that can ignite fires. But as you mentioned earlier, part of it is that not only are we warming as the planet warms, these forests are drying out. And particularly coming off of a conversation about hurricanes, where we're talking about a warmer, wetter atmosphere fueling these hurricanes, how is climate change making these forests drier?
Well, again, it's another equation, and I hate to use numbers, but if you look at, for every 2 degrees Fahrenheit, you need 15% more rainfall is needed to restore the balance between a wet forest and a dry forest. And second, these rising temperatures intensify drought and disease, and those kill trees, and when dead trees are kindling. And the third part of it is that the warmer it gets, the more lightning there will be. And you think about it, lightning accounts for a third of the fires in the boreal forests of North America and 80% of the area burned. And I'll give you an example. In Alaska in 2015, there was a slow-moving thunderstorm that crossed through the state, and it produced 61,000 bolts of lightning 15,001 remarkably electric day, and those lightning strikes triggered 270 fires. Just over 5 million acres burned. It was extraordinary. It was one of the biggest fire seasons in North American history. And we're looking at a doubling of lightning strikes by mid-century because of climate change.
There's climate change, which is a human impact in one sense. And then there's more direct human impacts on our forests that make them perhaps more susceptible to wildfires. How much of a role does our history, recent history of fire suppression and perhaps the longer history of controlled or prescribed intentional burning, how do those forestry management practices play into the scenario that's playing out right now?
They're huge. I mean, we've inherited a lot of old growth forest, which isn't bad, you know, for a number of species, but
which in fact we've come to think of those old growth forests as the gold standard, what we would want from a forest, right?
Yeah, but that's not what it was before we arrived on the scene. Before we arrived on the scene, there were a lot of lightning strikes. Fires were allowed to burn themselves out. We also had North American native people on the landscape that purposely started fires because they understood that it cleared the land. It also attracted wildlife back to the area because an old-growth forest is not particularly good for moose, elk, and grizzly bears. And a lot of berries and mushrooms grow up immediately after a fire. So when we started creating, for example, national parks such as Yosemite and Yellowstone, the policy at the time was to kick out all of the North American native people because, for one reason, they started fires. And we didn't want tourists to be in harm's way, and we wanted these lovely, lush, green spruce and pine trees in our forest. And so right around 1910, after what was called the Big Burn in Idaho and Montana, the policy was to suppress every fire that ignited in the forest. And so we essentially created this huge, vast reserve of old trees, many of which are dead or dying because of drought and because of disease, because these trees are not nearly as resilient as young trees. And you look at California, 61 million cedars, you know, dead in parts of California. And this is just, again, as I say, to belabor a point, it's just kindling in the forest. And when lightning strikes or people, you know, accidentally or purposely start a fire, there's nothing to stop them.
I'm talking with Edward Struzik of Queen's University. He's the author of Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. We've been talking about how climate change affects wildfires, but there's also a feedback loop here because these fires are helping to liberate greenhouse gases from forests, which should be a carbon sink. They should be sucking carbon dioxide into these trees. How much of a role is wildfire playing in exacerbating the climate change problem?
It's huge. And I'll give you Alaska as another example. Prior to 2007, the tundra, you know, on the north slope of Alaska and in Canada and northern Russia, it didn't burn. It was just too wet, too cold. But in 2007, the north slope of Alaska burned big, and it burned for a very long time. It accounted for 40% of the area burned in Alaska that year. No one had seen anything like that, and paleoecologists have gone in, and they haven't found any evidence that it's happened in the last 7 or 10,000 years. And in that one two-week, three-week fire, it liberated as much carbon as the entire circumpolar Arctic absorbs in a single year. And not only that, but, you know, all of the particulates, that black carbon that's emitted lands on top of glaciers and on sea ice, and that blackness absorbs more sunlight, and it really accelerated the melting that occurred in the Arctic that year.
There are so many different impacts of these fires. I mean, there's direct home damage or infrastructure damage. You write about water supply contamination, the health impacts of the smoke, and of course the economic impacts not only of the damage, but then lost labor and totally rearranging towns that are affected by these fires. And yet, as you've said, we seem not to be facing up to this reality. What are some of the things that scientists and experts that you've talked to say we could be doing and we should be doing to be more resilient in the face of wildfires?
Well, I think number one is that we've got to change some of the rules and regulations and laws that govern living in forest environments. I think the, you know, Florida has a law in place which gives the state the power to burn areas that would probably burn otherwise if they were started by lightning. You don't see that in other parts of North America. Secondly, I think that we've got to do a lot more prescribed and controlled burning that is done currently in the national parks. But that's pretty difficult, you know, when you've got so many people living and working in around the country's forests now, because they may be put in harm's way. I think the other thing that can be done is that we've just got to have better building codes in place so that if people choose to live in the forest, you know, they can't build a wood house, they can't have cedar shake shingles on their roofs. You would probably have to do something about the landscaping. You can't have ornamental cedars next to a wood house with cedar shake shingles. And I think that many communities, we probably should have buffer zones around those communities. One of the problems with Fort McMurray was the forest abutted, you know, they were right next door to these residential subdivisions. And so the firefighters couldn't anchor themselves in between the fire and the people. And this thing just steamrolled in and overwhelmed the firefighting efforts. So there's a lot that can be done.
That's Edward Struzik. He's a fellow at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Policy at Queen's University in Kingston, Canada, and author of Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, a new programmable shape-shifting material based on octopus skin. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.